Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, and here today we're on New Books in East European Studies with my guest, Vladislav Davidson. And Vlad's new book is just out. It is called From Odessa with Love, Political and Literary Essays from Post-Soviet Ukraine, published by Academica Press in Washington and London with a foreword by Peter Pomerantsev and a preface by Simon Montefiore. Thank you, Vlad, for joining us, for taking time with me today.
It's really great to be here. I've been a great fan of your work and of this particular podcast for a very long time. Great honor to be here with a gentleman such as yourself who really knows the area of studies well.
Well, that's so generous of you to say that. I love the fact that you've written a book on Odessa, which is one of my favorite cities in the world. And so I wanted to introduce you for people who don't know who you are. For our general listening audience, this is Vladislav Davidson. He is a Russian-American writer, translator, and critic. He's well known as the founder and chief editor of the Odessa Review. He writes for Foreign Policy and Tablet and is currently a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. And Vlad was born in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, and lives in Paris, although leading into my very first question, I get the feeling that Vlad is very much still the peripatetic cosmopolitan living between cities. And I want to ask, Vlad, why you wrote a book, at least in part, with your reportage about Odessa.
Yes, indeed. I cannot stop myself from moving around. This has something to do, I imagine, with my dislocated childhood, moving from Uzbekistan at 4 to Moscow, to America, to Europe, to moving around a lot when I was a kid. Clearly, I've in some ways recreated my early experiences of moving around continuously and learning new things and looking at the world. Excellent preparation for an international journalist, I would say, which it was. So I have had a love affair with Odessa since 2010. I have been going there every year. I used to spend the summers there from 2010 to 2015 on. I lived there for a couple of years during right after the Maidan, when the war started, when Russia invaded Ukraine. I am a big fan of the city. It's wonderful. It is everything that I like. I also spent a lot of time in my childhood in Little Odessa in Brighton Beach, amongst other places in New York City. So, you know, when you're a Russian, Ukrainian, Jewish guy from Uzbekistan whose grandparents are evacuated out ahead of the Nazis to Central Asia from the area, I mean, without going into my grandparents' background, and you grow up in Little Odessa and you have a connection to the Russian world and the Ukrainian world, as I do, Little Odessa takes you all the way up to Big Odessa. And as Peter Pomerantsev writes very generously in his foreword to my book, my reverse flow was what showed him the genius of the age, which is a completely silly thing to do, to immigrate from America to Odessa, is the opposite of what most people do. So he thought it was very funny and amusing and generative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask maybe about some of the similarities that you draw in your writings in the 2010s between, as you say, Little Odessa and Big Odessa. So it's a world of Isaac Babel, but it's also a world of entry, and the port in many ways, I think, represents that both in New York and Odessa. So maybe tell our listeners what the world of Odessa represents to you, both in literature with all of its gangster history, let's say, and interesting cultural figures, and then to the present in the 20-teens when you went back.
Well, a lot of the main guys or the protagonists of the world that we live in terms of organized crime or the intersection of literature and organized crime and the intersection of American politics and organized crime, they get their start in Odessa. So, I mean, I can give you a lot of names. So you have the legend of Odessa as written by Isaac Babel, which we're all familiar with. But then you have a lot of contemporary characters, hitmen and killers, characters like Mr. Satter, who was close to Felix Satter, who was close to Donald Trump. He comes from Odessa. His family comes from Odessa. I can give you multiple other characters who pop up and go back and forth between Odessa and New York, who are an organized crime. But mm-hmm. you know, there's a continuity. So when I got to America in the 1990s, we were living in Brighton Beach. That's the first place we wound up, and all these characters who were let out of gulags and let out of Odessa because the Soviet Union needed to get rid of them and wanted to make problems for the Americans, they all went to New York and they all got their springboard or their start in the New World, in a place that is not dissimilar from the old world. So there's a real continuity. And it's something that I saw a lot of in my childhood growing up in Brooklyn. Pre-gentrification Brooklyn in the 1990s. So I was well prepared for this world way before I put.
So I'm particularly interested, Vlad, in the book. I have several favorite essays, and I'm really partial to the one that you wrote about your life and in an intellectual journey through your formative years at City University in New York. You have a beautiful piece on Marshall Berman. What was it, let's say, that led you through the universe of New York intellectuals back to the old world, which I might argue is really a new world of Ukrainian 20-teens politics and patriotism?
That's a great question. Thank you. So there are a lot of obituaries in this book. I really like writing about people's lives, and the obituary is a form that that is not always easy to get right, but I like writing obituaries. And I wrote an obituary, an essay, appreciation for my teacher, Marshall Berman, political philosopher. He was a Marxist, and I studied with him in CUNY. He was active before he died about a decade ago in 2012, 2013 in CUNY. I studied with him at the CUNY Graduate Center and Hunter College. And he was like the last generation of New York intellectuals. I mean, probably, if you're into intellectual history, he was of the third generation of New York intellectuals. Of course, Kazin, Alfred Kazin being of a second, and Susan Sontag and those people being of a second. But when I was in college about 15 years ago, when I was at university, those people were still active. So I studied with the last generation of the real New York intellectuals, like Morris Dickstein, who was a teacher, Marshall Berman. Those people were still around. They were still teaching at CUNY. Alfred Kazin was already not active. I think he already had died by the time I'd gone to the university. But I'd really grown up in between cultures, and I was really trying to piece together as a young man what it means to be an American, what it means to be a post-Soviet Jew, what it means to be a Russian or Ukrainian America. And I was reading a lot of these books from the 1920s and 30s and 40s, like Irving Howe, you know, World of Our Fathers, Alfred Kazin's Walker in the City, Norman Mailer, that sort of stuff. I was really interested in that entire intellectual trajectory because I was at City University, CUNY, way after its heyday, although Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center were fine. I got an excellent education. And anyone who goes there and reads books and finds people who want to talk to them will get an excellent education. But it's, you know, it's not Harvard. It doesn't cost you $250,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about that a lot. I mean, that's one of the many vanished worlds, I think. And the Brooklyn gentrification environment that, that you speak of. Let's talk about the content of the book. So in terms of contents for Odessa with Love, these are dispatches or maybe reportage is a better word. You have five sections, I think. So, sorry, more than that, actually, nine sections. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you and your editor, I know this is Paul Duquesnoy and others with the press, decided to arrange this. The first section is on Odessa, but what else did you include in the book?
So, you know, I've written or edited hundreds of pieces over the last 10 years as a journalist, writer, literary critic. I had material that I had always wanted to write about that I'd never got around to telling those stories. And I thought it was time, like my story about Thomas Sillison, my friend who is a Danish businessman who foolheadedly bought a building in Odessa and went to war with the Odessa mob and basically, you know, won because he's just such a fun character. And he sat them down and plied them with alcohol and mead and bread. And as a Viking of old, he won his conflict with the Odessa mob. So there were lots of stories like that that I knew were great and I never got around to writing and I always wanted to put in a book. There were just a lot of stories which are important for understanding the trajectory of Ukrainian culture as a building thing in between 2015 and 2020, and Odessa, which is a city-state unto itself and is not really generally part of lots of other processes, stands apart, but although really is important for understanding lots of things. And so I really wanted to write about Ukrainian culture as it's being built after the Maidan. It's a tremendous new national culture. After the Maidan, you have the birth of a new civic national identity, a civic political culture. And I knew that there was a lot to be done on the interplay between that and Odessa. There's a lot of the best people in Ukrainian culture, from my young friend, let's say, Nikolai Krabinovich, the young conceptual artist, to my wife's business partner in their film production company, Alexei Gludyshevsky, who's a big guy in Ukrainian television in Kyiv. These are people who are born and come out of Odessa, and they maybe moved to Kyiv, in Gludyshevsky's case, to make film, or they moved to Europe, Brussels and Belgium, in Krabinovich's case, to make art. But lots of people, including my wife, come from Odessa and go to Kyiv or go to New York or go to Russia or go somewhere else in order to make stuff. So Odessa is an important place historically. It is still an important place. It's not as generative as it was in the 19th century, of course. It's not the New York City of the Russian Empire as it was in 1880 and 1890, when it really was the center of the universe for lots of stuff in Eastern Europe. But it's still an important place that launches a lot of important careers and shapes important personalities. So I thought it was very useful to get that process down onto paper and to connect it to the creation of a national cultural identity, a civic national identity, which is being shaped even as we speak.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested, Vlad, in how you explain and describe Odessa historically. And I have a lot of questions I can just ask about the city, but I'm fascinated as a student of Patricia Hurley, my beloved advisor, one of the first sort of Western historians to come in, by your take on the medieval city-state and say, political clans who turn into sort of mafia groups within the city. I think sometimes of Odessa as an Italian city-state, like the Sforzas and the de' Medicis and so forth. Yeah. And I wonder, you know, this I think is a brilliant analogy. I wonder how that grafts onto the often like basic apolitical nature, maybe even aesthetic nature of Odessites, and how you see that especially unfurling in the context of the Maidan and after. So there seems to be a great, you know, to put words in your mouth, durability of those political clan, if not mafia networks. And I wonder if you might say a few words about that.
So yeah, there's a lot to say there. Let's unpack all that. First of all, Patricia was just absolutely fantastic. You were a very lucky man to have gotten the chance to study with her. I led the very last talk that she ever gave in public at Harvard with her. I think it was two, three years ago, 2018. I came to Harvard to do a talk on of Ukrainian cultural industry, and I led a talk with her about her last book. She was absolutely chic and fantastic and fun. She created Odessa historiography almost single-handedly, and she did it in an interesting way, exactly as you point out. She went to archives in Italy when the Soviet Union was still closed, and she found a lot of stuff in European archives from Italian diplomats and French diplomats. She very cleverly figured out the early history of Odessa working in Italian archives. And a lot of it was grain manifests from Italian captains who were coming back to, let's say, northern Italy from Odessa with stuff. And a lot of it was from Italian architects who had gone over there to build stuff. Odessa has the highest concentration of Venetian Gothic Revival architecture anywhere in Europe.
Yes.
It looks like Italy or a 19th century, early 19th century Italian architect's fantasia of what Italy looked like 200 years ago for a reason. And there is something to the fact that it still has a, let's say, not leadership structure, but a ownership structure of the political space by various actors that much resembles, as I think I've said in the book, and as you point out, Italian city-state family architecture in Florence or in Padua in the 15th or 16th century. And Odessa's special because it has a large middle class. It's different from lots of other cities in Ukraine for that reason. Unlike Lviv, it's not run by one person. That's often the case in large Ukrainian cities, is that one local oligarch or one local macher or one local political baron runs a pyramid that decides everything. In Odessa, it's very much a consensual system with a lot of different players, as we've already said. It's not really run by a cadre of mercantile elites, without going into other cities, comparing it, let's say, to Mariupol or Sevastopol in terms of ports. It's run as a fiefdom with mob structures controlling lots of things. And also the fact that as I've said in some of the pieces in this book, Ukrainian intelligence services don't always control all the processes that go on there. It very much is reaching back to its 19th century heyday as a city of Porto Franco, which, you know, doesn't pay taxes, by being a kind of modern day Singapore or Hong Kong like city state. So Saakashvili, who was there, Governor Saakashvili, former Georgian president Saakashvili, understood this very well when he was in Odessa. He really got the mythology correctly. He figured out that people look back to the 19th century when the city was very wealthy and successful, and when there were no taxes to be paid, when it was a Porto Franco city until the 1850s and 60s. And it has this kind of hybrid culture of mercantile mafia capture with local intelligence structures and security structures having a piece of the pie and keeping Kiev out in exchange for, you know, some percentage of the goods. So it's a very complex city in terms of the way it's actually run. The mayor of the city is continuously, let's not say anything libelous, but it's continuously.
Let's not say anything libelous.
Let's just say BBC, the BBC has had investigations of the current mayor. Yes. I write about the mafia structure in the city, I think in a very amusing manner, if I do say so myself. You know, it is a city that's run by people with, let's again not be libelous, but connections to intelligence structures and mafia structures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I won't put you too much on the spot, but I will and I won't. I want you to talk about Saakashvili and some of these political elites, and it's really up to you who you want to introduce, but you have some interesting turns of phrase when you're talking about Russiagate, especially less so Ukrainegate. I think that's going to be your next work. You have this story, as you mentioned, the Viking who defeated the Odessa Mafia and erected a runestone. I wonder if you just might share some of these stories in order to offer our listeners and readers a window into political culture. Who are these elites? I mean, how are they behaving on top of the skepticism and the satirism and the comedy of local Odessites?
Let's tell some stories. Yeah, without naming the guy who I'm talking about, although everyone who's connected to Odessa will know exactly which real estate developer I mean. A certain gentleman I visited in his office. He actually sat in the same office that the legendary Greek mayor of Odessa from the 1840s and 50s, Marazvili, used. He is sitting in his office and he invites me in and we have an interview and we have a conversation. And he asked me basically how to bribe his daughter's way into Stanford. That kind of thing.
I know who this is. Yes, go ahead.
Let's not be libelous, you know?
Yeah.
And he later ran away to the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and he's still sitting there. And he controls a lot of real estate in the city center. And he's straight up a guy who you can come to agreement with, as we say in Odessa. You can come to an understanding with this gentleman. Another story, Saakashvili arrives and Saakashvili starts making deals with everybody. And he gets the nod in 2016 to be the governor of Odessa region. He thought he could spend 18 months remaking it in the form of Georgia, as he remade Georgia in a wildly successful and wildly controversial fashion when he was the president there. He really thought that he could do the same very quickly in Odessa. He wildly overestimated his capacity to do so. He wildly underestimated the support that he would be getting from Kyiv. He wildly underestimated the resentment and resistance he would be engendering from local political elites, a few of whom he could fight at once, but not all of them all at once. He thought that he could steamroll his way through the political class and bring in his own guys from Georgia and take power in the region and get rid of everybody he didn't like, put some people in jail, form a Russian-speaking center-right political party, and take power in Ukraine. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
He was wildly mistaken in his capacity to do so. And there were a lot of interesting things that went on. But, you know, just a few stories. I get a call at 1 in the morning from one of his aides. He says, Vlad, you're an American citizen. I said, yes. Can you help us? I said, yes. What would you like? It's 1 in the morning. Why are you calling me? I never, you know, it's very curious. I'm just sitting, writing, having tea. 1 in the morning, get a phone call. Very curious what they want from me. Oh, a Ukrainian is having his factory being taken over in the middle of Odessa. It's a foreign investor. He's having his factory taken over by quote-unquote Titushki. They've invaded the factory. They're on the grounds of a factory. They're demanding that the factory ownership be transferred from a Ukrainian. So why are you calling me? Oh, it's a Ukrainian-American. Okay, good. All right. Why are you calling me? Can you call the American embassy? We don't want to be the ones to call them. It'd be nice if you called. because they obviously had some sort of relationship with this Ukrainian-American foreign investor. So yeah. I called the American embassy at 1:30 in the morning and said, oh, Saakashvili's people want you to send someone over to keep an AMSIT, quote-unquote, American citizen from getting his property stolen in Odessa. I don't know why they didn't call you yourselves. So that kind of thing happened once a week while he was there.
I mean, this is a larger question because you're dealing with culture and politics and policy and intelligence circles all at once. As a journalist, I'm intrigued by Saakashvili. I wonder, because you describe him as quixotic, how you cast.
And
yeah,
erratic,
and inconsistent because, he imagines himself in 2015 as coming in and suddenly being able to do this in a couple of years. And I would argue that his project would probably take several generations. And I wonder if you share that same impression both about him and some of the other so-called anti-corruption reformers. And I would even put Zelensky in this category, but I mean, how long does it take, I guess, in a city like Odessa to start these giant quixotic projects of reform?
Look, Saakashvili, it was all fun and games, and it was a lot of fun, and the parties were great, and all the international journalists arriving, and it was the center of political life for a little bit, and it was just fantastic fun. I'm not going to lie. I had the time of my year, I mean, not the time of my life, but a great fun year. In 2016, when all this was going on, it was tremendous fun. He's a ball of energy and a tornado, and he was creating tremendous energy and everything. But he wasted someone else's opportunity with his tomfoolery and his erratic behavior and his lack of follow through and his lack of structured capacity to get anything done. He really wasted a once in a generation opportunity. We're not going to get another opportunity to redo things in Odessa for another 10 years at the very least. So yeah, I mean it's a bit unpleasant that he wasted someone's opportunity to actually do something serious, but yeah, it would take certainly years to get that done. It would take 5 years of his energy if he was actually committed to getting it done in the way that he said he was. It would take at least 5 years. It wouldn't take a year. It would or 18 months, as he said. It would take 5 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Ukrainians love to say that they've done more after the Maidan than they did in the previous 25 years. It's absolutely true. They didn't really work on restructuring the country or building a new national identity or reforming things for the first 24 years. They basically swapped out the symbols of state of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic for the blue and yellow flag and the trident and all that. But they didn't really create new building blocks of identity. They didn't really create new reform processes. They didn't really create an alternative vision, you know? Anyone who ran around with the Ukrainian flag, and that's a good thing from my perspective, before 2014 was basically an ethnic nationalist to one level or another. That's no longer the case. Now the symbols of state are symbols for everybody who wants to partake in them, and anyone who's born in Ukraine or anybody who holds a Ukrainian passport. And it took 24 years for Ukrainians to begin that project, and they're just at the very, very, very start of it. It's going to take, you know, development theory tells us between 30 and 70 years. It's really going to take literally two generations, you know, and we're only 7 years into that project.
Yeah, and I think, you know, yours is an opening salvo in writing about this reform agenda. I'm interested, Vlad, if you could speak about some of the other figures. So Paul Manafort is a big figure in, if we can talk a little bit about him and what he does. And I guess if we're not dealing with him directly, perhaps we could talk a little about the Ukrainization of American politics and the Americanization of Ukrainian politics, and especially as, you know, a lot of these swamp masters, for lack of a better word, end up in Ukraine and begin kind of transforming the culture of political parties and lobbying environments.
So yeah, I've spent a lot of time looking into Paul Manafort. I find him fascinating for completely different reasons that lots of people in the West find him fascinating. And I don't really think the story of what he was or what he did has really truly been told. Although Frank Foer, who's a great guy and a nice guy and someone I talk to and someone I see sometimes, did a lot of good work. And if you want to understand Paul Manafort, I think you should read my book and you should read Frank Foer's pieces. But I don't think really the entire story of what he represented has been told. I think he represents on different registers, one, the at the highest level, the political consultants and pollsters who came to the post-Soviet world and taught the Russians and the Ukrainians how to do polling and how to run consultancies and how to do political parties and how to run a modern political campaign, which was a normal process. Someone was going to do it, and they were in the right place in the right time with the right skill set. But they also brought a lot of sleaze from the West to Ukraine, and they brought a lot of new, equally filthy skill sets back to America. So I've always said to people, I don't think Paul Manafort knew how to export money from an offshore into Kazakhstan and through the Seychelles into America before he was in Ukraine. And he was being paid by local oligarchs who were having to pay a tithe informally to Kiev. You know, he would give his invoices to Bankova and they would ask local oligarchs to chip in as a form of informal taxation, really. So that's very interesting, the way he brought, again, not to be libelous, a certain Odessa power broker, oligarch, politician was paying him. Mm-hmm. through certain structures, investment vehicles, and black structures in Kiev. The black ledger stuff is very interesting, but I'm not really interested in that on for its own sake. I'm interested in what he represents in terms of the bringing of American political warfare to Ukraine and back. So I've said this to multiple people in Washington D.C. for generations. Kiev was seen as an ATM machine where you can get a lot of money for almost nothing. So there are a lot of political people, you know, even people like Bob Dole who were making easy lobbying money
back to Ford. I might say even, you know, it goes back before Reagan. One could argue.
Oh, no. I mean, from like 98 or 99 onwards, it becomes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Bob Dole, like 10 years ago, was making lobbying money. Those kinds of figures. I mean, I'm just not going to single him out, but lots of very serious people in D.C. were making money. People connected to the Clinton campaign. People connected to the McCain campaign. People connected to the Clintons. You know, a lot of people were making money in Ukraine. And it was easy money, and they were making it hand over fist. So I write about the way that American partisan politics comes to Ukraine, and Ukrainians are at the forefront of a international movement for different political forces in the rest of the world to take sides within American politics, which is very bad. Either with Republicans or the Democrats, thus making enemies of the other side. So Ukraine gave the subtext of a lot of it was that some factions in Ukraine were backing the Clinton campaign and others were backing Trump, you know? And it's because of the end of a Cold War and because of the end of a consensus of what American foreign policy is or should be or what it's for, that you have no more rules in Washington, D.C. or norms or even, let's say, good manners about what you can or cannot do as a lobbyist or as a political operative or as the son of a vice president. Hint, hint. Without going into that gentleman's malfeasance in Ukraine, there are no more rules or norms emanating from Washington, D.C. about what American elites can do. So from Manafort to McCain's aides to the Clintons who clean up going to a certain Ukrainian oligarch's powwows and flying around on private planes. Lots of people in American politics are making money, are consulting, are doing all sorts of things. And the Ukrainians, or some Ukrainians, get in the habit of intervening in American politics on the side of one or another political party. Now, this is not unique to Ukraine, but this is a new development that takes place over, let's say, the last 5 to 8 years. And it leads directly to Russiagate and Ukrainegate in lots of complicated ways that I try to tease out in this book.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wonder, you know, in comparing the option for Odessa, at least relative to, say, Kharkiv or maybe Kyiv. I don't know if Kyiv is the best comparison, but, you know, Kharkiv, if you look at what these Americans who came in did, do you see the level of transformation, this political transformation that you mentioned persisting after the election of Zelensky in 2019, I guess? You know, what has really changed? and then with Trump gone after 2020, can you give us a sort of prophecy here? Do you see the swamp stinking even more of sewage, or is there some possibility for the anti-reform wing to win out locally?
Are we talking about Washington, Kyiv, or in the regions of Ukraine?
I guess if you compare Odessa to some other cities in Ukraine, because, you know, you have an axis here, right? One of the axes is Odessa to Kyiv. Are there other cities within, you know, the world of regions, not the party of regions, which is defunct, but within other Ukrainian cities where you see the possibility of this kind of anti-corruption campaign working?
Look, I really think that these things have to come top down from Kyiv, and Kyiv first has to take control of a city in a much more serious way than it has control of it now. I've really come to that conclusion. There is a lot of civic activism in Odessa. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, especially post-2017. There are Ukrainian nationalist organizations. There are young guys with running around with guns and khakis and all this who are ready to defend the city if it gets invaded. There are more civic activist groups and all this. But really, it's a drop in the ocean, I think, in terms of political power. I've really looked into a lot of it, and I've spent a lot of time with activists. There's just not the same level of activism in terms of governance outside of particular issues like historical preservation, which is fairly strong in Odessa, because lots of people love the city center. On particular issues, you will have activism that sees rewards, but on the port and actually what goes on in the port in terms of tariffs and in terms of who actually gets the money from the port, I don't see that happening until you get another strong character like Saakashvili taking over again in a couple of years and cleaning it up. Mm-hmm. In Kyiv, again, it's the capital, so it's not fair to make a comparison. But you can't compare it to a city like Lviv or a city like Kharkiv or Dnipro. These cities all have completely different dynamics internally, politically. They have different kinds of political pyramids that run them. The development in Odessa is like no other city in Ukraine for all sorts of reasons. It's completely unique. And it has to do with the fact that it really is the last port standing. I mean, Mariupol is just not as big or as important as a port. It really there's a lot of trade coming in from Turkey and Asia through Odessa. So just the fact that the shipping is the main thing in Odessa makes the political development of a city very different from a city like Dnipro, which produces things, or a city like Kharkiv, which does a lot of business, especially with Russia, or used to. Mm-hmm. So, I'm loath to make comparisons between big cities because every city in Ukraine is different in the way it's run, and the political economic structure, or political economy of Lviv is probably very different from Chernowitz, where some of my ancestors are from. You know, and Odessa is unique in many ways, and already I've explained partly why that's so. But yeah, I don't see anything changing on a macro level until the rest of the country changes in Odessa, partly because it's so isolated from lots of other things and buffeted by protectionist rackets run often by people in the security services. Again, without saying anything libelous.
Sure. Yeah. I don't want to ask every question about policy, but I wanted to return to some of your essays on cultural life. And I think some of these are really remarkable. You have an interview with Hobart Earle, who's, you know, life and work. This is the director of the Odessa Philharmonic. And,
oh, he's fantastic.
He's just an amazing person. And Yuri Andrukhovich, of course, who's one of my first, you know, loves of Ukrainian literature. You have an interview with him. Could you talk a little bit about this life on the ground? I mean, I'm thinking the things that are there that maybe our listeners who haven't been to the city are not aware of, like the Green Theater or, you know, the Philharmonic. What are those things representing to you, despite all of this mess, you know, through Russiagate and Trump and now Ukrainegate and beyond? But what are those structures for you?
Yeah, I really don't want to sound like this book is unhappy. It's a happy book in many ways. It's a very hopeful book. It's a very loving book. It's a love letter to the city that I love and to this country that I love, obviously, from Odessa with love. And in fact, you know, not uncoincidentally, James Bond is from Odessa, the Jewish guy who his life is patterned on. The film was, and the novels are patterned on, is a Jewish guy from Odessa, a spy from Odessa. And it's a city of spies and thieves and all this. But it's also a city of culture historically and still. And that has something to do with the cosmopolitan demographics of it and the fact that people are continuously coming in from other parts of the world to do things there. Partly it has something to do with just the city, just the architecture, just the maybe just the air, the sea around it. It's just a lovely, important place, and it produces interesting people for that reason. Culturally, it still punches way, way, way above its cultural weight, although a lot of the first-rate figures have moved away. Sadly, a great friend of mine just passed on, a very important figure, Alexander Roitberg, the painter, who was the director of the Odessa Art Museum, just passed on about a month ago.
He died of COVID, I think, right? Was it?
Yeah, you know, he had a lot of problems. I knew him very, very well for a long time, and he had a lot of problems stemming from his very vigorous consumption of alcohol and extracurricular narcotics in his youth. He had a very, very, very fun 20s and 30s, and his health was shot. He had liver problems, and he had other issues. So he was knocked out of the world by COVID, but he had other comorbidities and health problems. But the main painter in the city was also the director of the art museum, and he just died, and he was one of the great public intellectuals of the city. I'm hoping to write a profile of him or a big essay on him when the time comes, maybe in a month or two, maybe in Tablet, in time for my second book, actually, which is going to come out next year, about the Ukrainian Jewish relationship. So there are a lot of figures that come out of Odessa, but a lot of them move away, if only to Kiev. So there are only like four or five real giants in terms of the culture who are still living there, including Boris Hersonsky, the poet, who is a real giant, and a few others we won't go into. But there are people like my friend Hobart Earle, who is an American, Venezuelan-born, who has spent 30 years shepherding the Odessa Philharmonic, who is this remarkable figure who I write about a couple of times in this book. And I have a long 8,000-word conversation with him in the book. I think it's worth the price of admission alone.
And what do you see Odessa producing? I mean, other than artists and comedians, this is one of the things Odessa is known for, but I love this focus that you have on gangsters and thieves. I'm thinking about the future of artistic life. And of course, you know, in any Ukrainian environment, this means patronage and oligarchs and things like that. Could you say a few words about that?
What is Odessa putting out? Odessa still produces a lot of young writers and filmmakers and good young painters. I have a lovely young friend who just finished art school in Der Haag. Sofia Bulgakova is a wonderful young painter. My wife represents she's a producer, a young Ukrainian filmmaker by the name of Anastasia Mamontenko, who is a wonderful young filmmaker. There's just a lot of very talented young people who come out of Odessa. And Odessa still produces very vigorous local art scene. There are still painters living there. Igor Gusev's fantastic painter. So the Odessa Philharmonic is still a very strong institution. There's a competing set of Odessa music festivals during the summer. The Odessa Film Festivals is a wonderful institution, which is now 10 years old, which is very important for the country and even Eastern Europe. I hope it continues on. There's been some talk of this year being the last one, but I'm hoping that it continues on into an 11th year. So Odessa still doesn't produce violinists like it used in the 19th century.
Right.
And the 1920s. But it still produces mobsters and good filmmakers and good poets.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this is my closing thought about your book. How would you describe your book as a collection of reportage for someone who would like to pick it up? Is it a book that's about counterculture? Is it a book that's about aesthetics? In your own words, why would people read it?
It's a great question. I endeavored when selecting my work to collect and writing new pieces to put the work together, to stitch it together, in having a very thorough thread line of a story about a city and its place in the contemporary nation and the development, the cultural development of that nation. So I see this book as a midpoint between an intro book to Ukraine. This is not the first book that you should pick up if you don't know anything about Ukraine. I'm pivoting towards people who already know things. You don't have to know a lot of things. I don't really write about the war or the Maidan. There's a lot of that already elsewhere. There have been accounts of the war. There have been accounts of the Maidan, some of them very good. I don't really write about Kyiv politics so much. And nor is this an academic volume, even though it's an academic press. This is a collection of pieces with new writings stitched together for the, let's say, experienced Odessaphile, for someone who knows something about contemporary Ukraine, for someone who likes interesting stories, for someone who understands the history of Ukraine Gate, for someone who is into statues. There's an entire section on statues where I tell the story of contemporary Ukrainian life through six or seven different statues. Statue of Darth Vader, the aforementioned Ruzhzone, the politics of knocking down statues. I wrote an essay about 2,500 words long for Tablet magazine about 2 years ago when there was a wave of statues being thrown down in the West, about what I learned half a decade ago watching statues come down in Ukraine. Now, this is not to say that I am in favor of statues of Lenin being kept up. I'm not. There should not be statues of Lenin in a country like Ukraine. But there's a lot to be learned from the process of the way they came down, the adverse effects of the way they came down, of the way that that process was slightly botched, and of the way that that process led to more ratcheting up of conflict and political polarization. There was a lot to be learned for the West from Ukraine and its experience of taking statues down. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a very long essay on what we could learn from that. So it's a book about contemporary Ukraine for, let's say, the non-expert, someone who already follows Ukrainian politics and Eastern European politics and wants to understand more and wants a deep dive into particular local dynamics, which I think I understand fairly well, having spent a lot of time reporting on them and living through them. And it's not really truly micro history. It's not really cultural history, although it's also that. It's not really only the history of the mob, although, of course, I go into that. It's not only five or six essays on Saakashvili, although that's important. It's not only a book about Ukraine becoming the new Chinatown, although that is that is the case. But it's a book about the way that culture, politics, and war intersect to create something important. Mm-hmm. I had a realization after I finished writing the book and I actually saw the PDFs in my hand that this book was about travelers who come to Odessa, lots of remarkable people, in the way that everyone winds up being in London once a year or in Venice once a year or for the festival or in New York for whatever reason or Paris once in their life. Lots of people who would never wind up in Chernihiv or Lugansk or Kharkiv or Mariupol or even Lviv. Lots of people throughout their life will wind up being in Odessa at least once for whatever reason. So there are cameos in this book from Svetlana Alexievich, from Piotr Pavlensky, from Bernard-Henri Lévy, from Michel Onfray. These are all people in this book who are international stars or international characters who wound up passing through Odessa on their way to something else. And that's always been the case with Odessa. I think it's really, really interesting. Michel Onfray, Bernard-Henri Lévy, Svetlana Alexievich, Piotr Pavlensky, they would never go to Chernihiv for any reason. But they will come to Odessa, and that will be part of their life travails and story. And it's important. The city is still an important crossroads for people's adventures in the world, including Saakashvili, who's also a world historical character, for the better or the worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think of that 2014 event that Tim Snyder put together on Ukraine Thinking Together. It was a seminal event, and there were so many people and, you know, presentations in six languages and just like an incredible sort of moment in May 2014 for people to have conversations. And
I was there.
Right. I wanted to go, but I had to return to being a boring academic, Vlad. So I'd love to see that again.
We should do that again. We should do an anniversary. In fact, if I see Tim, I'll tell him to plan another one. That was with another Ukrainian case of lots of interesting people arriving there. It was before the New Republic was
decimated. Leon. Yeah.
In fact, I walked around. I took Leon Wieseltier around Kiev for a little bit. We walked around with him a little bit. He was there, as was the Facebook gentleman who owned the New Republic at the time. I saw him at the next table drinking. But to return to your question of what my next work is, I'm putting together a lot of my work on Ukrainian-Jewish relations into one book. I'm putting together a book that will be out in the spring about Ukraine and the Jews post-2014, what it means, what happened, what the situation was for the Jews as the heuristic for the creation of a new national cultural identity.
Well, that's exciting. Will that be published by Academica as well, or...?
No, that'll be with Ibedim Verlag and Columbia University Press. So that'll be co-published by Ibedim Verlag and Columbia.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we are fresh out of time here at New Books Network. And we've been speaking, or I have been speaking with Vladislav Davidson. His new book is called From Odessa with Love, Political and Literary Essays from Post-Soviet Ukraine. With a foreword by Peter Pomerantsev and a preface by Simon Montefiore. This is published by Academica Press in Washington and London, just out 2021. Vlad, thank you so much for your time and for this lively conversation. I'm really grateful, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
And I'm your host here at New Books Network, Stephen Siegel. Until next time.